I'd like to thank the organizers, Joe in particular, and all of you who share this time for this discussion with me. I'm very happy to come back here. I was here 4 years ago, and I think that this is the wonderful institute for providing a really nice environment for having discussions and research.
It's all being recorded, so that's good.
Good. Did I turn it off? So I think I have a right to speak about my dream first, rather than getting into the technical details. But my dream is to derive all of our nuclear physics from string theory. That's a very high attitude, right? So I suppose that this is a first step toward this very high attitude for conquering the empire of nuclear physics from string theory. This work has been done with Sakai and Sugimoto, so you can easily guess that this work is going to be about the Sakai-Sugimoto model. Okay? So let me start. So first, in maybe 6 or 7 slides, I'd like to give you my motivations and our strategy for attacking this kind of problem from string theory to nuclear physics. I'd like to say that, in my opinion, most of the application of ADS CFT to QCD has been just for hadron physics and not nuclear physics. And people who have other subjects in major have an opinion that hadron physics is nothing but nuclear physics. But it's not true. If you ask a hadron physicist or a nuclear physicist, then they have a strong opinion on the distinction between those two. And actually, the most of the application of ADS-CFT to QCD was this hadron physics, and not really nuclear physics. So what is nuclear physics? This is a two-line review of nuclear physics. Here it goes. So nuclear physics is divided into two parts. One is the light nuclei, and those can be studied by nuclear force. If you have a nuclear force between two nucleons, then you can think of this as a medieval problem of quantum mechanics. So this nuclear force is a very important ingredient for studying light nuclei. On the other hand, if you have heavy nuclei, which consists of, for example, 100 or 200 nucleons, then this kind of study makes no sense because it's a huge amount, a huge number of nucleons which are interacting with each other. So it's a really complicated quantum many-body problem. And for these two, there are different approaches. For light nuclei, as I said, this can be studied by nuclear force, and also you can put it on computers and do huge computations. And for heavy nuclei, there are a lot of empirically well-behaved effective models for describing those heavy nuclei. So for attacking this kind of problem, we need to, of course, divide the problem into two parts following this observation. So first, so in this talk, I talk about light nuclei. And for this, nuclear force is essential. However, unfortunately, there is no QCD derivation of nuclear force so far, although this is the most important object in light nuclei nuclear physics. So what is the nuclear force? Nuclear force is schematically written like this. You have a distance between two nucleons, and this is the potential. So you have a bottom here around which those two nucleons are stabilized. For example, let's consider deuteron. Deuteron consists of proton and neutron. And proton and neutron comes together by this pion exchange force that is a long distance nuclear force. And then it comes to a certain range at which this potential minima can be reached. And then if you want to put it on top of each other, then there is a very strong repulsive force coming up like this. So this is known from, of course, experiments, and I'll come to that in detail later. So there are two features of this nuclear force. You have long-range pion exchange that has been known for a century, and then you have a short-range force that is a strong repulsion for any kinds of nuclei, it is supposed.
Sorry. To what extent, even for light nuclei, is it a good approximation to think of a two-body force rather than three-body?
Oh, I see. Yeah. So that is just a consequence of so what people simulated using this two-body force only. And then
from QCD, you might think a three-body force should.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, that's true. So eventually, it turned out that two-body force is almost sufficient to reproduce, for example, the excited levels of energy for light nuclei, ranging from, say, helium to calcium, that kind of things. Yes. But there is a very small deviation, and that can be. So now, the topic of nuclear physics for light nuclei is to introduce those three-body, four-body interactions to reproduce this very small deviation. So in principle, as you said, there are there should be many other strong forces, but it is known that this two-body force is very effectively reproducing the levels.
So if meaning like to 1%, 5%?
I think we less than 1%.
Less than
1%. But of course, it depends on what kind of nuclei you are describing. For example, if you have an unstable nuclei, or if you have a neutron halos around nuclei, then that gives you some complication. But for stable nuclei, it is known that it's enough to have two forces, two body forces. So as I said, there is no derivation of from QCD for this nuclear force. And now we have at our hand this holographic QCD, which actually captures very nicely the strong coupling behavior of QCD. So we can, of course, we can use this holographic QCD as a holographic QCD derivation, not QCD derivation, but holographic QCD derivation of nuclear force. And this is what we have done by the researcher for the period of maybe 2 or 3 years. So the first one describes the long-range force, that is a pion exchange. We computed pion nucleon-nucleon three-point coupling, and that can be integrated to give the behavior around here. And also for strong short-range force, this strong repulsion is has been a really long-standing mystery in nuclear physics. And we have used this holographic QCD to reproduce the short-range strong repulsion. So using all of this, we can actually write this potential exactly in this holographic QCD. And hopefully, we can use this to reconstruct all of the nuclei using this nuclear force. OK. So how about heavy nuclei? So this has another.
Yes. Sometimes one says the repulsion is due to rho exchange. Is that? I mean, presumably.
Yes. So
exactly that picture.
Yeah. So actually, I'll come to that point later. Yes. So people have thought that this is another meson exchange, like rho and omega, and from this holographic QCD we can see explicitly what is contributing and so what is not contributing. Yes. And that's really interesting aspects as for the history of this. So how about heavy nuclei? So if you remember Gross, Ogree, and Witten's baryon vertex in ADS-CFT, then actually you have another idea for attacking this kind of problem. So here, body is in ADS-CFT, it's a baryon, so it's a baryon vertex. And the baryon vertex is a D-brain in ADS, right? And then you need to collect many of them, and that means that you have large A nucleon number, where A is an atomic number. Okay, so if you look at this one, then of course I think you should have come up with an idea that you have a combination of large A and D brain. So we may have a possible gravity dual for heavy nuclei. That's a wonderful idea, I think, and I come up with this. Okay. You should laugh here, okay? And then, so I like to propose that for heavy nuclei, we can explore this ADS-CFT facility to very, very in detail, like precision holography, as Joe said last week. So we may have a gravity dual for heavy nuclei. And that is a work in progress. And I in this talk, because of time, I will not talk about this. But if you have an idea, then please come to me and have discussions. Okay, so what is a repulsive core? I've come to some experimental results. So nuclear force is, as I said, this short range, you have a strong repulsion. And for example, for lattice QCD, for light nuclei, this kind of empirically known nuclear force have been used. So there are several lines here, and so several groups are working on this, and each group has a different nuclear force. But the common thing is that you have a very strong repulsive core here in a region of the distance less than 1 femtometer. And long-range force is, of course, very well known. So this is a pi exchange, but if you go to shorter distances, then you have 2 pi exchange, rho omega sigma exchanges, and also you have a repulsive core if you go get closer.
There's a strong spin dependence, is that right?
Sorry?
There's a strong spin dependence?
Spin dependence, yes. That's right. So there is a very strong state dependence on nucleons, and here this figure is for isosinglet spin one sector. And there are other nuclear forces for each sector, yes. And the experimental data, which should be consistent with this, is, well, of course, one is a nucleon scattering. If you scatter nucleons, then you can analyze that with this kind of potential, in addition to the spectrum analysis of nuclear excitations. And also, it is known that nuclear density is almost saturated for any nuclei. Means that the radius of any nucleus has a nice dependence on this atomic number A. It is going with the power of one third. So it means that nucleons are like a very hard balls. And if you collect balls and put on top of each other, then you have this A dependence because of this volume in R cube. So this is nothing but the reflection of the fact that we have repulsive core, the central region. And this is a picture which is taken from some Japanese textbook. Here you have if you can read this, then this is a really graduate course, very basic. And in the second page of this book, there is this figure. So this is very, very basic one. So you have a nice dependence on A. This is the radius of nuclei, and this is the atomic number, or mass number. And then it comes like this, mass number goes like this. And for these are very unstable nuclei. So you can neglect this. And for stable nuclei, and actually this goes like this, so until 50 or 70. So you have a nice nuclear density saturation seen from here, and this is very. So from this, you can understand that this reproduction of repulsive core is a very important concept in nuclear physics. So what are theoretical approaches for this repulsive core in the past 30, 40, 50 years? The first one is, of course, quark models, I should mention. There is a very famous MIT bag model in which you consider three quarks inside a bag. And inside a bag, you have a perturbative vacuum of QCD. But outside of the bag, that is non-perturbative vacuum, the confinement. So you put some boundary condition along this bag surface. And then you consider some excitations by using QCD. Or rather, some quark models with some Fermi-like interactions. And it has been known that the repulsive core due to Pauli principle can be easily understood in this context. So quarks are fermions, so that those are subject to Pauli principle. So if you want to put them on top of each other, then there is a repulsive force. But after that, after some observation, actually this Pauli principle is not enough to reproduce all the strong repulsive force between nucleons. So there are a lot of studies, but this, of course, depends on what kind of boundary condition you put on the surface of the bag. And that needs the non-perturbative information of QCD. And that is remaining to be done. And for skirmions, yes?
How close does the Pauli principle story get? I mean, is it sort of an order one effect, or is it completely trivial compared to the actual experimental data?
So I was told that from say Yazaki-san that so you can reproduce this response for you on using only the public principle up to maybe 50 or 60%. Yeah, and other effects comes from some spin-spin interaction and such. So how about skirmions? Skirmions are just baryons which are constructed as a soliton of pion effective field theory. So if you have pion effective field theory with some pion nonlinear interaction term, then you can solve the equation motion, and the soliton of that is considered to be a baryon. And that is the nice thought by a skirm. And then if you put two skirmions very close to each other, then some people show that there is a repulsive core. But unfortunately, in this skirmion approach, because of the fact that the equation's motion is completely difficult to solve, this computation relies on some ansatz for the solution. And if you change the ansatz, then the repulsive force changes. And that is a serious problem. And no one knows, for example, how to solve two skirmion exactly in this system. So for one skirmion, you have an exact solution. Although you don't have an analytic form, you have a numerical simulation. But for two skirmions, there is no exact solution. So that's a serious problem.
Okay.
And yes, please.
Why is this not a problem that can be attacked numerically for the two skirmion problem?
Probably it's possible now because we have a very good computational power. But 20 years ago, no one, you know, so you need to put some ansatz to reduce the free parameters. So maybe it's possible now to have just two skirmions. But even though you get some solution, then the next step is to quantize those solutions. Then it's a further very complication that comes through. And how about lattice QCD? So this, so we have a very nice improvement these days. And actually 2 years ago, there is a nice paper by these people which gave the nuclear force for the first time in lattice QCD. And this is a result. These are points, a lattice QCD result. And this is a one pion exchange potential. So this is a long range part. And now you see some repulsive core here. But lattice QCD, of course, needs more computational power to get to the realistic region of nearly massless pions. And for this model, the pion mass is maybe 3 times greater than the realistic value. So there is a problem. So, and also, this is a quench. So one needs to do some more job to reproduce this possible core. So our attitude is here, as you see from the history, the first principle analytic derivation from strongly coupled QCD is missing. So we use holographic QCD to get this repulsive core, and hopefully we can compare the result with, for example, this lattice data. That's a very important. Okay, here is our strategy. So it's very nice to have a comparison with the skirmion because we are going to have a solitonic nature, a solitonic baryon from Sakai-Sigmund model. So you have skirmion, which is a solution of pion effective field theory, that is a four-dimensional nonlinear Sigmund model. And then on the other hand, we have a soliton solution of Sakai-Sigmund model, that is five-dimensional Yamel-Chan-Simon series. I'll come to the details of this later. And then we can solve the equation of motion for a single soliton, and that is nothing but the instanton solution. You have one more dimension which is coming from the holographic direction, so you have four spatial directions, and that is localized in these four spatial directions, so you have instanton in this Yamel's theory. And it is hairy because this Chan-Simon term comes into play, and I'll come to that in detail later. So in history, Adkins, Snappy, and Witten got an exact solution with using some numerical simulations, and then they did a soliton quantization to get baryon spectrum in 1983. And then after that, in the same paper, they computed chiral currents using this solution and baryon wave functions. And that gives you a charge radius, meson baryon couplings, and so on, but only for the pion sector. And then after that, as I mentioned, there are several papers which you try to get the two soliton sector from this screw model. And then you can get, in this effective model, you can get nuclear force at short distance. So this is a history. It's almost 20 or 30 years old. And then what about us? We have a holographic QCD on your right. And then 2 years ago, Hata et al. And Hong et al., they computed the baryon spectrum using this solution by quantizing it. I'm going to review it shortly. And then our first work is completely parallel. You can compute chiral currents using this formalism. Once you get an effective action for mesons, then you can do very parallelly the computation of many things like chiral currents and such. And then after that, we have a two soliton sector using this Lagrange. So in view of this, so the history parallels each other. So it just says that, well, we have no brilliant idea to, you know, beat these kind of people compared to our very nice facility of ADS-CFT. Well, actually, there are a lot of differences between these two. So let's focus on that. So on your left, you have skirmions, but this is not just an effective theory. So and you don't know how effective this is, okay? And also, it includes only lower mesons. You have pions, and of course, you can include low mesons, but you raise the number of free parameters here. So it's a very bad point for this skirmion. So you if you introduce many particles, then you have many free parameters to be adjusted. And you need a lot of experimental data to fit these parameters from the first place. Then what is the prediction? What is the input that is getting more obscure? For example, on your right, we can say that this is derived from QCD. Okay, so this is a kind of philosophy. You can adapt this or you cannot adapt this. That's up to you. Then a nice thing about this is that you have an infinite number of mesons from the first place. And also, you have only two free parameters. That's amazing. So here you have only lower mesons. There are many free parameters, but we have only two parameters. And the experimental results can judge whether this model is true or not. How about two soliton sector? Here, because we have much more baryon states in a unified manner, so we can explore many more things. And for two soliton sector, as I said, there is no exact solution. There is no analytic solution, even for one skirmion sector. On the other hand, in our case, because we are exploring the Yamnall's instanton dynamics, we have exact solution with complete moduli. So that's very important for stating that actually you have a repulsive core or not. So these are distinctions between these two. And if you want to add more, then please do that, or you can subtract more. So this is our strategy. And here is the last of my introduction. Okay, so one-page review of Sakai-Sugimoto model. That's what is Sakai-Sugimoto model? Sakai-Sugimoto model is this. I can do introduction for many brain configuration and such, but I skip all of those. And the Sakai-Sugimoto model is this. You have five-dimensional Yamnall's Chan-Simon action, and Yamnall's action is in a curved space that is specified by this Z. So you have a metric factor here and here. Those are different. And the only dimensional full parameter is put to be just one, MKK scale. I said that there are two parameters. One is this MKK, that is fit to be about 1 GeV, and also this lambda, Tofluft coupling. And Tofluft coupling is chosen to be around 20 or 30. So those two parameters are chosen to fit rho meson mass and pion decay constant. And that's all. And what you can expect from this very simple Lagrangian is the total aspects of hadron physics. Okay, so how do you get the infinite number of mesons from here? What you do is just a Kaltz-Klein fluctuation analysis of this theory. So the background is just a gauge field is equal to zero. So you can expand the gauge field around this flat back around this zero background, and because the background is curved, you have a lot of cross-occurring state. So it's an effective compactification of the z direction. And from A mu, you have vector meson power spectrum, and from AZ, you have massless pion. And other massive pions are absorbed into these massive vector mesons by a fixed mechanism. So this is it. And I need to explain the meaning of this Z in this holographic description. So this is a typical Sakai-Sugimoto configuration. You have D4 brains, and D8 and D8 bar are intersecting with that. And this direction is compactified on a circle. That is S1. And this radius of S1 is given by this MKK, 1 over MKK.
So in the usual Skirmion analysis, do people need more than vector mesons? Do they include spin 2 or higher?
So there are many papers which included those higher spin fields. Yes, that's true.
For them.
So of course there are some motivations to introduce that, but I'm not sure about that because so motivations are very different in each paper, and there is no universal reason why you need to introduce higher spin fields. And if you replace this D4 brain by the background given by Witten, then the resultant theory is like this. You replace this D4 brain by a black hole geometry in which you have no spacetime in the core region. And that forces D8 and D8 bar to connect it by each other, like this. And Z direction is this. So Z is minus infinity is on D8 bar, and Z infinity is on D8. So you have a continuous parameterization of D8 bar and D8. And the important thing here is that the chiral symmetry is realized as a gauge group on this D8 and on this D8 bar. And now it is joined, but the chiral symmetry is restored at the asymptotic infinity, where you go to Z equals plus infinity, then you have left-handed chiral symmetry. On the other hand, if you go to Z minus infinity, then you have right-handed chiral symmetry. So that's important to derive chiral currents from this picture. Yes, but of course after the expansion you can just abandon or just throw away very massive modes. You can do that, but here all the massive mesons are already included in this simple picture. What do you mean? Yes?
And the true science term doesn't look gauge invariant.
Oh, here? It should be gauge invariant. It's a Chan 75 pole. Of course, I omitted some wedge product here, and you are thinking about these coefficients?
No, I'm just, I mean, usually, like, you know, in three dimensions, this is A wedge F. I mean, the higher terms of A's come from, you know, the curve, the commutators in the F's.
So here, that's the standard generalization from three dimension to five dimension, I guess.
Normally you write it as A D A plus A cubed.
Oh, sure,
but if you write it in terms of A F, you get this.
I mean, are you sure?
Yeah.
That's a little great to me, but
okay. Even three dimensions is two thirds.
Right.
No, I know.
So we can discuss this, and we are going to use only this term in the later discussions. But these are important for reproducing, for example, the meson interactions. Okay. So I did the introduction. So I have three slides for these. I'm sorry, this should be four. Or I can skip this part. This should be four.
You call this holographic QCD. Can you say what sense is this holographic?
So I skipped all of those things, I'm sorry. So here, on your left, you have a D-brain picture in weakly coupled sense, and on your right, you have a gravity picture. So this is CFT, and that is CFT, and this is gravity, ADS. And now, we are talking about meson sector rather than the glue ball sector. on the usual ADS-CFT refers to the global sector, that is gravitons, okay? But now we add flavored D-brains like this to get left-handed and right-handed quarks. And we are interested in those dynamics rather than the gluon fields. So now we go to the gravity description. So I replace this perturbative D4 brain by its black hole geometry, and then keep these D8 brains as just probes. So that's why you get this kind of higher dimensional gauge theory from the effective D-brain action on the D8 brain. So this has 9 dimensions, but it can be reduced to 5 dimensions because this direction is S4. And you consider only the singlet sector of this S4, then you can reduce this 9-dimensional action to 5-dimensional action. That's how I can get this. And the fields here, so this theory is describing the gauge boson on this D8 brain. And gauge boson is like this, an open string on the D8 brain. And that can be, in this picture, understood as a bound state of these two mesons. So in the case of a usual ADS-CFT, you have gluon, and you consider a gauge singlet gluon composite. That corresponds to a gravity mode on the other side. Right? Now you have a chiral fermion, left and right, so you consider a gauge singlet due to these two combinations. Then get an open string on this D8. So that's why this theory is supposed to describe the mesons from this large end QCD-like theory.
Just to make sure I understand, the Lagrangian you've written describes the meson sector of the theory,
yes.
Not the entire QCD
theory. That's right, that's right. So in addition to this meson sector, of course, there are baryons and exotics, including gluballs. And baryons are coming out from this as a soliton, and gluballs are coming from gravity sector. So you need to couple this to background gravity, and then you can compute meson gluball interactions and such. But gluballs are not known in detail in hadronic data, so it's difficult to make a comparison directly. So people are mainly working on this meson sector. You have any question? Okay, so I'll give a brief review of baryons, that is a soliton, and then I'll quantize it. Then we come to a computation of experimental data. And the comparison with the experimental data is a fun part for this. So let me start the review. Baryons are Yamil's instantons that has been known for more than a decade. Gross, Ogling, and Witten showed that actually in this type 2A setup, you have D4 brain wrapping S4 is a baryon. In the ADS5 process 5, you have D5 brain wrapping S5, that is a baryon vertex. And now we have a flavored D brain, that is D8, that also wraps this S4. So if you count the dimensions, then there is 4 co-dimensions difference. And that means that this is a localized object in 4 dimensions on this D8 brain. And on D8 brain, you have gauge theory. And of course, it is well known that the smaller D brains can be understood as instantons on larger D brains. So now you have a clear understanding that baryons are instantons on this D8 brain. And it is localized in these spatial directions and also in Z. So this is the Lagrangian feature I've written, and let's look at the Chan-Simon part here. If you have an instanton charge, then this part is integrated to be non-zero if you make an integration over this space. And that sources this A0. This is a wedge product, so if you have non-zero instanton density in this space, you have A0 sourced by this instanton. And this A0 lies in the U1B sector. B means that we are considering vector path because two D brains are already joined. And then this U1 is the overall gauge group of this theory. This theory have UNF gauge group, and F is the number of flavors. If you consider two flavors, up and down, then you have a U2 gauge theory. And this U1 is overall U1 of this U2 because of this wedge product on this trace. And this U1, or overall U1 of the chiral symmetry vector part, is nothing but the baryon symmetry. So it means that if you introduce an instanton charge, then it also has a baryon number. So that's a very simple explanation due to this Chan's Hamiltonian in five dimensions. And now we are going to have an exact solution and quantize it to get a baryon spectrum. So let's do that. So first, I assume that this instanton size is very small compared to the curvature of the space. That's the first assumption, and we need to check it after we get the solution. And it is also assumed that it is localized at z equal to 0. So it is at the tip of this geometry. Then the background can be approximated by a flat space. Even though we started in a curved space, if you assume that the size of the instanton is very small, then you can approximate the background by a flat space.
Z equals 0 is not a horizon, it's just the minimum radius, is that
right? Right, there is no horizon.
Because of the IR, it's just the low, you need the IR cut, the effect of the IR
yes.
cutoff.
Yes, yes. So it's a very smooth IR cutoff, and it is located there, yes. And in the case of ADS5 cross S5, if you put the baryon vertex at the horizon, then it means that baryon size is infinite. And now there is a cutoff, so it minimizes the size. The solution is very simple. It's a BPST instanton plus some electrostatic potential coming in the overall U1 part, as I said. This is the explicit solution. You have BPSD instanton solution. That is this. GZ is defined as a distance from the position of the instanton in this four-dimensional space. And also you have this trivial gauge rotation here. And also you have electrostatic potential that is given by this. What I did is to plug this BPSD instanton in the equation motion back and then solve the U1 part. That's very easy. And actually, inserting this solution back to the action leads to a slight potential. Because here we neglected the curved space effect, that should comes in as an expansion of the instanton size versus the curvature. And that small part comes in like this. So this is the potential induced for the size of the instanton and also the position of the instanton in the Z space. And this one comes from the U1 Coulomb self-repulsion because it has a baryon number, baryon density, and it of course has an electrostatic potential, self-potential. And that is this in four dimensions, four spatial dimensions. And also you have two terms that comes from the curved space effect. And from this you can stabilize the potential by choosing an appropriate number for rho and z, like this. And from this, you can see that the classical value of rho is of order of 1 over square root of lambda. And that is very small if you take large soft coupling unit. So this assures our assumption here. So this is a solution that's very simple. And the next one is to quantize the instanton. That's also very simple. So we have moduli of the instanton, that is location of the instanton, and also four numbers, yi. Yi squared is the size of the instanton, and the other three combination is the gauge rotation of SU2 instanton. So this is a standard parameterization of moduli space of one SU2 instanton. And you have a Lagrangian, this is a kinetic term for these fields, and also you have a potential, which we obtained before. So what we have done, what we need to do is to quantize this quantum mechanical system using this potential by upgrading these moduli to a time-dependent parameter. That is a Solitone quantization. Yi is now acted by this SO4, and SO4 can be divided into SU2 cross SU2, and those are interpreted as isospin and spin. And also, Z and rho, these have a potential. And that is a harmonic-like potential, so you can do some harmonic expansions, and baryons are labeled by these numbers, quantum integer numbers. So that's it. This is a simple quantization, and you, for example, you get a proton wave function from this quantum mechanics that is given by rho wave function, z wave function, and y wave function. And rho and z are, of course, described like this in explicit manner. So that's it. So we are going to use this wave function to evaluate various quantities of baryons. And for neutrons and also higher excited baryons, labeled by these quantum numbers, can be computed in a very simple manner. So let's come to the nuclear force at long range. What are the static properties of baryons? Of course, the most basic one is the charge radius. And also, we need to know pi and n coupling. And those kind of things can be computed by chiral currents. If you have a chiral currents explicit form of this, then you can compute all of these things. Charge radius, magnetic moments, axial radius and axial couplings, and also three-point Yukawa couplings and so on. So let's compute chiral currents. The chiral symmetry is, as I said, it's a UNF gauge symmetry at z equals to plus infinity and minus infinity. And if you want to have an explicit expression for currents, then what you do is to gauge the global symmetry to gauge symmetry and think about this deviation. That's the standard procedure. But in this case, it's already gauged. Now we have a chiral symmetry which is gauged. So it means that we need to evaluate this action by putting some boundary condition for the gauge field like this. If you go to z plus infinity, then you have left deviation, minus infinity, that's right deviation. And the coefficient of this, substituting this to the action, and the coefficient of those should be the chiral currents. So this is easy procedure. And starting from the action, you can get chiral currents like this. It is in terms of this field strength, but it's evaluated at z equals plus minus infinity. And you need to substitute the solution of the instanton back here to get a chiral current for nucleons. So that's it. So now we have an explicit expression for chiral currents, but the evaluation at z equals to plus infinity is a little bit technically difficult. Why is that? Because we have a flat space solution, and we assumed that this is enough for getting a solution. But the value which you need to evaluate this chiral current is at z equals to plus infinity. And here you have a curved space. So there is a problem. You cannot substitute the flat instanton solution to that expression. What we can do is as follows. We consider this region. It's difficult to see, but this is shaded by yellow. This is a free region. You have a flat spacetime, so you have a free green function here. And that can be extended to curved space green function because instanton is very small. So you can extend this free green function to curved green function to get the data here. Now that you can do. And these are, that can be connected smoothly. So in a sense, you can have a solution to the full curved space for the case of one instanton. So let's do the computation of experimentally important values. How about the baryon number? Baryon number current is very easy. That is a U1 vector part of the chiral current, and that is normalized like this. And baryon number is, of course, equal to 1, and we define the baryon number density as rho b of r, given by this. So this is the current which we computed, and we take an expectation value with the nucleon wave functions. And using this, for example, you can compute isoscalar mean square radius, r squared of iso singlet sector, defined like this. You substitute this to this, and you get some explicit number for this. For example, in this Sakai-Sugimoto case, you have a result of isoscalar mean square radius as 0.742 femtometer. Here we used an input, as I said, MKK, that is a Kaufmann current scale, and Toft coupling lambda. A kappa is a function defined by Toft coupling lambda. And these two inputs are fit to reproduce pion decay constant and rho meson mass. and we get this result for baryons. And also, vector current can be computed in the same manner, and isovector charge density we can compute. That turns out to be eventually equal to the baryon number density. So using this, we can define an electromagnetic charge using isovector and isoscalar part as a summation, and you get charge radius of proton and neutron. And charge radius of proton is because of this, it is equal to this. And also for neutron, this gives a negative sign, so it gives you zero. And this is the upshot of our, the summary of our computations. Here you have important quantities for nucleons, proton charge radius, axial radius, magnetic moment for proton and neutron, axial coupling, and pi n and Yukawa coupling, rho n and Yukawa coupling. Vector coupling. And these are experimental values. And these magnetic moments are, as usual, normalized in a Bohr magneton unit. And for skirmion, there are a lot of computations, but the original one by Adkins, Napier, and Witten gives you these values. Unfortunately, this diverges because this is a pion effective action at massless limit. On the other hand, we have these values. This is a judgment time. If you see that, let's see. So I used three digits, but there is no sense on this. You know that there is 1/NC corrections, and NC is 3. So it means that 30% error should be expected. And here, within 30%, I think it's a nice agreement. And the most important thing is that we used input only by these two parameters. And that's important. And also, not only for these nucleons, you can compute also for, say, some excited baryons. So here, as an example, I computed delta excitation for, and moments, magnetic moment for delta. And we have poor understanding on its experiments. But if you include lattice, then lattice QCD recent data shows these values. And it's very close to these observations. So this is very encouraging, even though there is no reason why we need to believe in these values, but eventually these turn out to be very close to the experiments. So the judgment time is over.
Your two words numbers there are actually the same number, right? Because they're related to the other ones we were earlier.
Which one then?
G sub A and G pi at n are the two words numbers.
Cover tree. Sorry.
Ah. That's right.
So you could leave one line off and make it.
Yeah. Right. Right. Okay, so let's come to the last part, nuclear force at short range. Now you can see that what we need to do is very kind of obvious. We have two baryons, that is two instants in curved spacetime. But it's very hard to solve them analytically because it's in a curved space, and we don't have any conformal symmetry. If this is an ADE space, you can do that. But we are in a generic non-supersymmetric background, so we cannot have generic solution for two instantons. So how we can proceed? So if you remember this picture, where actually we approximated a single instanton by a flat space, and the bump of this instanton is localized on this flat space-time region. Then if you can add this another instanton not far away from the original one, like this, if r, the distance between these two baryons, not exceeding this order one separation, then you can put another baryon like this to use flat space approximation. That is our idea. So when lambda is very small, you can always find this region, and then this means that baryons are very close to each other. So you can use Yamil's two instanton in flat space. And fortunately, we have ADHM construction for instantons, and we can fully explore all the moduli details of this configuration. So we have 16 moduli. That is twice of the single instant moduli number. And the computation is quite involved. And I want to show this in detail. So this is a summary. If you insert the two instant solution back to the action after solving the U1 part also, then you get this Hamiltonian for quantum mechanics. You have the Hamiltonian for the first instanton, for the second instanton, and this is the interaction term. And we are interested in this interaction Hamiltonian. An interaction Hamiltonian looks like this. You have a basic 1 over r squared coefficient that is intrinsic to four spatial dimensions. And then you have instanton moduli dependence. This is for the first instanton, this is for the second instanton. And you cannot get closer enough because we neglect this dependence. Here, a square root lambda is missing here, but we consider just the leading order of this two instanton configuration. And then nucleon-nucleon potential is given by taking a web of this interactional Hamiltonian by using two baryon asymptotic wave function. We have just a tensor product of two proton wave function, for example. You can replace this by neutron and other baryons as you like. Then the result is this. This interaction Hamiltonian can be divided into two parts. This is a standard distinction, dividing this Hamiltonian into two parts. This is a central force, and this is called tensor force. And tensor force is a coefficient of this operator, which, if you take a trace, this vanishes. And this central force has been computed using this approach to get this. And this is a spin operator for acting on the first and second baryons. This is an isospin operator. And also for tensor force, you have this result. This is independent of the spin. And these are showing a very important fact. That is, first of all, if you look at the center force, you have a very strong repulsive force here. This is a plus sign. And also you have some spin-isospin dependence here and here, but this is not strong enough to cancel this repulsive force. So it's a very detailed calculation. You cannot easily see that classically this is repulsive and that's it. It's not the case.
How does this compare with
Rho? Yes, I'll come to that in the next slide. So, and also the significant fact is that you have 1 over r squared potential rather than 1 over r. 1 over r squared is a harmonic function in four spatial dimensions. Because we are using holographic recipe, this is natural from that perspective. But from the standard understanding of QCD, you need to sum up all the mesons to get this 1 over r squared potential. So it is very important if this result can be fit with the lattice data or experimental nuclear force potential. And this is our result. And in Japan, I asked my friends who are doing lattice QCD, and they are going to fit this. And eventually, they said that, our potential can be fit by 1 over r squared. I was amazed. And I told him that it's saying that this is a holographic dimension. But they just don't believe it. But I'm really excited with this. So this is the details. This H1, that is a potential nuclear force at short range, can be divided into three parts. And three parts are like this. It's complicated. The first one is Coulomb repulsion in U1 sector. And the second one is curved space. And third one is curved metrical moduli space of two instantons. But you can completely neglect almost all of these things. And what is essential is this one. So you end up with really detailed calculations, and you can see that all of these are rather small compared to this. And this is the origin of the repulsive core of nucleons. So what is this Coulomb repulsion? That is actually dominating this repulsion. It is a power starting with omega meson. And omega meson couples to the baryon number, as I said. This is a U1, overall U1 part of flavor symmetry. And if you decompose the calcocline in the calcocline way of this gauge field, then it starts with omega meson.
That's just the I equals 0 part.
Yes.
The I equals 1 part?
I equals 1 part, that is coming from, of course, the raw meson. And that is in the previous. So here it's responsible for the raw meson. Yes. But the total repulsive force is coming from the omega meson exchange, dominantly from this. So this is I think this is the standard understanding of meson researchers, in which if you have an omega meson, then that has a very strong repulsive force at short distance. That's why actually Nambu introduced omega meson more than 50 years ago. It's called rho zero at that time. And he introduced this omega meson so that he wants to reproduce the neutrality of the charge radius of a neutron. And that's why he introduced this omega meson. But as a side effect, he mentioned that this omega meson can contribute a repulsive nuclear force 50 years ago. And it's amazing that there is no analytic reproduction of the state domain of this in QCD. We are using holographic. Yes. Yes. That's right. That's right. Yes. Yes. That's right. Yes. For the raw meson. Maybe I should put those papers here. Thank you very much. Next time I'll do that. Okay, so here's the summary. We have used holographic QCD to attack the problem of nuclear force. We compute nuclear force at short distances, and we reproduce the repulsive core, and it's to be fit with the lattice QCD. And also, we compute the static properties that gives you a long-range nuclear force, and they nicely match experimental data. Well, that's it. Thank you very much. Yes, please.
So this tower of states, which is giving you the big dimension,
yes.
Of course, it's not the Regi excitations because you've thrown away all of the Regi excitations.
That's right.
It's the radial excitation of the meson, that is the internal, mm-hmm. like the S, mm-hmm. like 1S, 2S, 3S, 4S, because that's effectively what you're keeping when you keep the fifth dimension. So it's, and I guess the question is, so whenever there are a few places, like the Gale limit, where this fifth dimensional degree of freedom really is the dominant one.
Uh-huh.
But is there any, I mean, if you just forget about the holographic model and just think about nuclear physics, I mean, first of all, have the radial excitations of any of the mesons actually been seen, do you know? I mean, we know the resonant excitations, but
yes.
Do you have the radial ones been identified? And is there any sort of field theory reason to think they would be the dominant things contributing?
As for highly excited baryons rather than mesons, mm-hmm. of course, skirmions and those effective models can give you some highly excited spin fields. And in those cases, I think that there is some identification in hadronic data, but not for mesons, I guess.
What is the mass, supposedly, with this, the mass splitting between this tower?
So here, if you do the naive computation from holographic QCD,
yeah.
then the difference between the first, this radial excitation compared to the bottom is has a factor of lambda, perfect coupling. So it's rather large compared to the calcocline excitation given here.
So the one of our screen is something over what for lambda?
So here, what we summed up is only
the
yes, that has the same spin, but it has excited more.
Yes. And the splitting there is what?
It's MKK. It's MKK is just the rho meson. MKK is the single dimensional parameter in this. Yes. That is 1 GeV. 1 GeV.
I just wonder,
1 GeV?
Yes.
Question terminology. I would say the KK of the excitations on the 3 or 4 scale. You've thrown those out. That's not.
That's right.
You mean the excitation in the Z direction?
Yeah.
Gary Cole's radio rather than KK. I mean, is it nicknamed different?
Oh, you meant this radio. Ah, so that's radio.
It corresponds to the breather mode of the network.
Ah. I don't think so. I don't think so. This breather mode should correspond to some stringy like oscillation. It might be some other.
It's a rescaling. I mean, obviously, moving in the z direction is a rescaling of the Hall hadron because it's a component that's So in some sense, you're keeping modes and non-dominant modes.
I see. In any case, all of these studies have thrown away those S4 excitations.
So what will it take to get that relation that you showed at the beginning? R is 1.188 to the 1/3.
Ah, that one. Yes, that is another project which is going on currently. And we need to, so the strategy is as follows. We need to solve this Sakai-Sigmund-Lagrange equation motion, not in the one instant sector, but large instant sector. So we need to have some answers, but you need to do that in large instant domain. And if you can solve this, then of course you should present this.
I mean, there's an infinite volume limit. I mean, is that right, where it's just nuclear matter? I mean, is that...
No. So there are some works on nuclear matter that takes infinite limit, but you keep this instant density finite.
Yeah.
But here we are interested in the nuclei themselves. So you need to keep it as a spherical shape, and then you put instantons there. And I think in that way, I can come to the shell models of nuclear physics, and also these giant excitations, giant resonances of nucleons, those can be understood in this model.
Okay, let's thank you.